sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabel, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service to public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour, an editorial review, is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. And the Law Hour and editorial review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on the R word, recession, when we come back. You know, in 1787, the writers of our Constitution put in this clause at Article 1, Section 10. It says, no state shall make anything but gold or silver coin a tender in payment of debt. And that clause follows the biblical injunction on just weights and balances that we see in Leviticus 19, verses 35 and 36. Well, private business is carried on in gold and silver coin. But public business is conducted in commercial paper. Commercial paper are things like stocks, bonds, Federal Reserve notes, credit, credit cards, debt, and usury. Well, back in 1965, the Congress said that there is no difference in the value of gold or silver coin and clad coin or currency. And you know, that's very true when we're dealing with banks, government, and commercial industries. But out here in the real marketplace, there's a 7-to-1 difference in the purchasing power of gold over paper, and there's a 7-to-1 difference in the taxes that are due on that paper over gold. Now, God and our founding fathers didn't give us gold and silver coin for no good purpose. They knew that as a matter of law, gold and silver coin was absolutely necessary for you and I to deal in order for us to protect our property rights. Well, neither did the government take our gold away from us for no good people either. The government knew, and they knew full well, that in order to subjugate a free people, they would first have to take away the people's gold and silver coin in order to take away the people's right to property and destroy their property rights. So if you and I intend to regain our rights, duties, and capacities, then it's absolutely essential that we regain our property and property rights, because property is the holy grail of law. It's the legal foundation of all of our liberties. Now, if you'd like more information about private business and private business school, why don't you call and order our free general law CD package? It's the place to start. It's informative, it's entertaining, it's educational, and it's free. You can call right now and order one. It's 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Our business school is also available on compact disc. On compact disc for adult home education. If you're online, you can go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Click onto the email machine. Send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Once more, that's georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. Well, Alan Greenspan the other day made a proclamation. He was making a speech or delivering a speech to some group, and he used the R word. It's kind of like the F word and the N word and these various words that are politically incorrect. And he said that in 2007, he says, very real possibility that we may have a recession. Well, I got to looking up the word recession, and as far as I can tell, it's when the economy gets below 2% growth. They call that a recession. Or if the economy in times past got below a growth margin of any amount, that was called a recession. And of course, if it dips below certain percentages, I don't know if it's 5% or something like that, they call that a depression, a contraction of prices. A depression is where prices reverse. You know, last year you paid $20,000 for that new Chevy. And if the price drops to $18,000, well, then that's called a depression. If the price goes up to $22,000, you know, then that's called growth. But you know, I got to thinking about that growth thing over here. They keep telling us, you know, the economy is very vibrant and it's growing and it's in good condition, you know. They keep telling us that, and I keep hearing that over the Katie Couric news and the Brian Williams news. In spite of the fact that real wages have not increased in the United States, adjusted for inflation, since 1973, they keep telling us, you know, the economy is strong and vibrant, everything's going fine. You're making more money than you've ever made in your life. I mean, you guys are making $16, $20, $30 an hour. You professionals, $38, $50, $75 an hour. Everybody seems to be real happy out here. But I've noticed that the debt load here in America constantly goes up. I don't know who's borrowing all that money. But when we borrow money and we spend it into circulation, then that they call that growth. They call that the consumer is driving the economy. 70% of the economy is driven by consumer spending. Time was when our economy used to be driven by production and business spending. Today it's consumer spending. So you go out and you max out your credit card, and that stimulates growth because it stimulates more empty shelves, which then requires that the merchant restock the shelves. You go into Walmart and you buy a pair of shoes, and so the Walmart people say, well, we sold a pair of shoes, so therefore we got to order another pair of shoes. And so they order another pair of shoes to replace the one that you took off the shelves, and they say, well, those shoes were $100, and they add that into the gross domestic product, and they come up to a number, and they say, well, it's running around 10 or 11 or 12 trillion dollars a year. And if you're employed at all, no matter what you're doing, you know, you feel real good about that. You and your wife are working out here today. 40 years ago, women didn't work so much in the workplace. For some reason or another, they've been persuaded to go to work in the workplace, and they seem to like it there. Seem to like it. Well, that's fine if that's what you want to do. But the combined incomes of mom and dad working in the workplace are not enough to buy the same goods and services that my dad could buy working by himself in 1955. And it's been that way in this country since at least 1973, that today it takes two wage earners in order to earn a living, in order to pay your bills, pay the mortgage, one thing and another. Back when I was a kid, they used to have certain stops. You know, they'd say, well, you can't spend more than 25% of your after-tax income on housing, that is rent and mortgage payments. And today it's very common for people to be spending up to 50% of what they earn on their mortgage or rent payments. Now, we would have thought doubled, you know, was preposterous. I don't say that's the average. I don't know what the average is. But it's over 25% now. And some people are paying up to 50%, probably some a few more than that. But do you really think that it's good for you to be making mortgage payments of 50% of your after-tax income and then wonder why it is you're unable to make the bills or unable to make the payments? So what is this recession that that Alan Greenspan was talking about? Well, I did a little arithmetic here, and I got out some of my newsletters. You know, the international forecaster, Bob Chapman, said that we've been in recession now for 18 months. 18 months. And that the government lies a lot with their statistics. And so the only place that you get statistics that tell you whether or not the economy is growing or the economy is contracting is the Department of Labor. Now, the truth of the matter is there are a lot of people out there in the field of economics, economists that work at Bank of America and Goldman Sachs and economists that work for other institutions. They're out there keeping track of this also. And they disagree with the government's numbers. And many of them are reporting now that the government's numbers are skewered in favor of the government and its claim that unemployment is low. So let's just take a look at one of these claims, the claim that unemployment is low. Unemployment is 4.5% of the workforce. So how does the government measure this unemployment? Do they go out and take a poll, kind of like the Nielsen poll, and they ask you, well, what TV station are you listening to, or what TV program are you watching? Are you watching Letterman, or are you watching Leno, or are you watching something else? And then they extrapolate that out and they say, well, you know, we got a plus or minus figure here, but we think that generally speaking over here, the number of people that are watching Letterman, you know, is 13 million people, or the number of people watching Leno is so many people and so on. No, they don't count unemployment that way. They go out and they count the total number of people that are drawing unemployment checks. And, you know, at first blush, that sounds like that's a pretty logical thing to do. You know, you go in here and you just ask the statisticians at the Department of Employment in California, well, how many people in California are drawing unemployment insurance? And then they say, well, how many people in California are employed? And they can look at the payroll deductions and tell you how many people were employed last week. And then they can look at the number of unemployment checks that they sent out last week, and they can subtract one from the other, and they can tell you what the percentage is. And, you know, for the average Joe Sixpack, that sounds pretty logical. That sounds pretty reasonable. Until we add in this vital statistic, and that is unemployment insurance only lasts for 13 weeks. So what happens to the unemployed after they've been unemployed for 14 weeks? And the answer is they're not counted. That's the bottom line. They're not counted. So if you've been unemployed for 14 weeks or more, you're no longer counted as unemployed. You're not counted as being employed because there's no payroll record or payroll stub to show you employed. But you're not unemployed because you're not drawing unemployment insurance. And we're only counting the people that are unemployed. Now, if we wanted to count unemployment based upon the number of people who do not have meaningful, productive, earning employment, or they don't have jobs, we would have to add in 18% of the whole black population in this country, because 18% of blacks are unemployed. Now, that doesn't mean that they're not hustling up a buck. I mean, they're employed doing something. They may be unemployed selling crack cocaine down on the street corner, or burglarizing businesses, or stealing automobiles and selling parts. You know, we don't know what they're doing, but, you know, those 18% are doing something. Here in our county, we're one of the poorest counties in the state, is Ozark County. We used to be the poorest. I think Oregon County is now the poorest, but the way they measure that poverty here is how many people are on welfare, or how many people are on unemployment, or how many people in the county's income is below the national poverty line. And I think this national poverty line is somewhere around, you know, $16,000, $18,000 a year. So if you're not making $16,000 or $18,000 a year, you're below the poverty line. That's where I'm at. I'm below the poverty line. I'm one of those that's poverty-stricken. Now, I never thought of myself as being poverty-stricken, but, you know, the government comes up with methodologies and modalities for making these calculations and then reporting it to you. So I just wanted to tell you that George Gordon is not living in poverty. I'm living very well, thank you. I'm not complaining. But I don't make $18,000 a year. So since I don't make $18,000 a year, they say, oh, that Gordon guy over there, well, he's below the poverty line. I guess they don't count such things as, well, I drink milk every day because I've got a cow, or because I eat very well every day because I have a garden. They don't count that in. You know, that's what they call subsistence farming. And anybody that's involved with subsistence farming has to be poor. That's the general consensus of opinion. And that if you're making a lot of money, now you could be an insurance broker in Connecticut making $100,000 a year, say, and they'd say, woo, now there's a guy that's very successful. Even though this guy making $100,000 a year may be in debt $500,000 buying houses and cars and things like that. And he's servicing his debt, and maybe he's paying interest, you know, of 14%, maybe $14,000 a year out of his $100,000 is going to interest. And maybe $17,000 a year is going to mortgage payments. And, you know, and maybe $24,000 is going to income and Social Security taxes. And when you get all through with it, you know, you get to figuring, well, what's this guy's real net income? How much mad money does he have? Oh, he's got about $17,000 a year of disposable income that he can dispose of any way he wants to. And he can go to Disneyland. And we call that great success in this country. Now, I measure success a little differently than that. And the purpose for this report here is I think that the United States of America is in recession. We've been in recession for 18 months. And I think the government lies about the numbers that they're giving us. But then you wouldn't know if you're in recession. I mean, if you're working and you got a job, you know, and you're working out here and the government says there's no recession and the economy is growing by 2% per annum, that makes you feel real good. And then you go down, you spend some more money. And then that kind of stimulates things because you bought a pair of shoes and Walmart now has to send an order over to China to replace those shoes. Makes you feel good, makes the government feels good, and everybody feels good. But is it really true? Because if we were counting the economy today the way we counted it in 1980, 1990, or 2000, if we took the hedonic adjustments out and then we actually counted the number of people that don't have a job, unemployment would be more than 4.5%. And if we calculated your wages today, adjusted for inflation from 1973 to today, you're making less money today than you were in 1970. And in order to make up the shortfall, to make up your standard of living, what we do is put your wife to work, give you a credit card, and put you into debt. And that gives you the illusion that you're living better. We give you more absolute dollars. I can remember when I was in the workforce many, many years ago, I was making $3.27 an hour, $3.28. And I was a machinist, a union machinist, and I was at the top of the pecking order. Now, I wonder what a union machinist is getting today, $25 an hour? When you're getting $25 an hour, and you ain't living as well as I did on $3 an hour 40 years ago. Now, what do you think of that? I mean, I'm not here to, you know, to blow smoke, you know, up your you-know-what, but I'm just here to tell you that things aren't near as good as you thought they were. And a lot of times people say, well, that's bad news, and that's why I don't like the news, because it's bad news. And I disagree with that. I think bad news is good news. Bad news is good news, because the bad news is it deals with reality. Deals with reality. Let me give you a reality check. Do you invest in stocks and bonds? Well, 50% of Americans are invested in stocks and bonds. And they must be good, because 50% more, it's 51 or 2% now of Americans. They must be good because the majority of people have these stocks and bonds. I don't have any, not a single one, which just goes to show you how stupid I am. Because those of us that are in the minority must be wrong. We must be mistaken. We must not have our heads screwed on straight. Now, that's the way we see things here in America. But I did a little research on this stock and bond thing. So let me give you a reality check here on stocks and bonds. Go back to 1960 to 2000, a 40-year period. If you take all stocks, and then average them out for 40 years, they increased in value by 5% compounded annually from 1960 to 2000, all stocks. Now, some stocks are pretty spectacular, and you've heard about some of these. For instance, the Bill Gates stocks, you know, the Microsoft stocks. Why, if you'd have invested in Microsoft coming out of the chute, why, you'd be worth multiple millions of dollars today. You know, and you didn't have to invest a lot. You know, $5,000 in Microsoft in 1980 probably make you a millionaire. But the bottom line is that there's 9,000-plus stocks out there. I think there's 9,600 companies, 9,600 stocks. And not everybody is smart and invests in Bill Gates. You know, some people invested in Studebaker and Packard and Hudson. Some people invested in Enron and Global Crossing and WorldCom, didn't they? Now, as a result of that, some people lose money and some people make money. Some people make lots of money. You know, it's kind of like that at Harris. You know, you walk into the crap table and you plunk down some bucks, and sometimes people walk out of the
out of the casino and they've got $5, $10, $20, $50,000. Hell, there's people that buy lottery tickets, boys and girls. They spend a buck, they buy a lottery ticket and won $200 million. That happens. We call it gambling. Now, you know, most people, they don't like to see or say that if they're investing in stocks that they're gambling. They don't like that word, and the stockbrokers don't like that word, and so I call it gambling, and that's what I think it is. But I got onto the internet the other day, and you can do the same thing. Just go to the Dow Jones Industrial Average, and then there's 30 stocks, and take those 30 stocks and get a report on each one of them. It's free, it doesn't cost you anything. And you download these reports, and then you just sit here and you start reading them, you know, and then it'll tell you, you know, how much money you're making. I mean, if you've got the stomach and you really want to find out, because I don't think most of you people really want to know. You got to have a place to put your retirement money. And so you take your retirement money and you invest it in your IRA. And then somebody, you know, will take that money and they'll invest that in some stock portfolio, some mutual fund company or something like that. And that makes you a stock owner. And here's what I discovered, though, on the Dow Jones. Now, these are called blue chip stocks, blue chips. They call them blue chips because when you're playing poker and you have this this chip, you have white chips, red chips, and blue chips, red, white, and blue chips. The blue chips are the more valuable chips. They're the ones that are worth $5. And the red chips are the ones that are worth a dollar. And then the white chips are the ones that are worth a penny. And you're playing penny ante poker, you know. And then you invest, you know, or you ante up one or two or five white chips. And then you get to playing, you know. And as you're playing, you start betting bigger and bigger chips. Well, the blue chips are the valuable ones. Microsoft is a blue chip stock. So I found that there was only about five of them that were paying dividends. Out of 35 of them were paying dividends. All the rest of them were losing money. And that's the Dow Jones Industrial Average. That's the outfit that's the blue chips. So five of them. Microsoft was one that was making money. General Motors, General Electric, and a Walmart, and then I think Coca-Cola. I think those were the five that were making money on the Dow Jones. And all the rest of them were losing money or they weren't paying dividends. Which would make me ask the question, and get this, Walmart and Microsoft don't pay dividends either. They've got a good profit margin, but they're taking all the money for you investors and investing it in new plant and equipment, new stores, things like that. And the theory behind this stock thing, if I understand this correctly, is you buy a stock for $50, just one share. I got a $50 bill, so I'm going to go buy one share of Walmart stock for $50. And then next year, that stock will be worth $55. And I've made a hell of a lot of money. I made a $5 profit on my $50, so I made a 10% profit. So I sell the stock, and then I pay my broker, and then I pay my taxes, and I take the balance of that, and there's my profit. And they talk to you, and they say, well, now, see, that's why we recommend stocks, because now if you invested that money in that stock, and you made a 5 or 10% gain in that stock over a long period of time, you'd make a lot of money, and that's true. And if you were to take, oh, let's say $100, and you invested that $100 at 5%, compounded, then you use the rule of 72, which is very simple. You just take 72, plug it into your calculator, divide that by 5% interest, and it equals 14.4. That means in 14.4 years, your investment will double. And that's good. That's geometric progression. And that's really good, really good. Now, remember I said that from 1960 to 2000, the average was 5% growth. It doubles every 14.4 years. Now, that's average. Some people make more, some people make less. But at the end of 40 years, you doubled your money three times in round numbers. So you invested your money, the $100 in 1960, it doubled to $200 and then doubled to $400. So your $100 doubled to $400. In fact, it went up by four times. That's phenomenal, isn't it? Isn't that really good? Yeah. And that's what they keep reporting to you. They keep telling you that. Well, now I did some arithmetic, and I discovered that the inflation rate between 1960 and 2000 was 4.8%. Now what that means is, that means that if you had $100 in the bank, in 1960, and 14.4 years later, that money is worth $50, and then 14.4 years later, its purchasing power drops to $25, and then 14.4 years later, it drops to $12.50. All right. Now here's where you're at. By investing in the stock market in 1960, you made $400. That's the good news. The bad news is the purchasing power is $12.50. Or put another way, it's $12.50 times 4, or about $50. Let's see if I understand this correctly now for all of the investing public out there. In 1960, you invested $100 in the stock market, and your $100 grew to $400. But at the very same time, the inflation rate every 14.4 years was cutting your purchasing power in half. Can you follow that? Let me give you another classic example. In 1980, to 2000, in that 20-year period, you lost 50% of the purchasing power of your money. And that's because prices doubled between 1980 and 2000. Let's try another one. If you had $100 in the bank in 2000, in 2006, that's right about now, it's lost 30% of its purchasing power. It now costs $1.30 to buy what a dollar bought in 2000. So you had to have a 30% increase in wages over the last 6 years. Did your wages grow by 30%? Did your profits grow by 30%? Did your stocks pay you 30%? Because that's what you had to have. That's just a break even. It gets worse than that, though, because stocks are profit. See, they're profit. So let's suppose that you made $400. You invested $100 in 1960. And then in 2000, you sold your stocks for $400. Now, that's a capital gain of $300. And the capital gain tax at that time was 28%. So let's take 28% of $300 times 0.28, and that's $84. Is that right? Just for funsies here. It's 28, 28, and 28 is what it is. 8, 16, 24, 2, 4, 6, 8, $84. So take $84 away from your $300. Don't you have $216 left? So you actually made $216. And the $216 lost $300 in purchasing power. Excuse me, boys and girls. But didn't you lose $84 here? All right, now here's the bottom line. Then the money changer, a guy by the name of Franklin Sanders, calls it ugly investing. It's reality. It's where life is. That's why I don't invest in stocks and bonds. It's because they lose money based upon purchasing power over time. You have to pay taxes on them because it's a taxable income. And I try to avoid income, you know, like I avoid AIDS, herpes, and VD. Now, that's called reality. The reason I like the news is because the news is a kissing cousin to reality. And reality keeps me out of the stock market, and it keeps me from losing money that way. Now, if you've got too much money and you don't know what to do with it, let me make a suggestion. Buy Roytan cigars and smoke them. I smoked Roytans for years and never had a bad puff. I enjoyed every puff on my Roytan cigar. Sure, it'll give you lung cancer. Sure, it'll kill you. But it'll be pleasurable. You'll love it. Or go out and become an alcoholic and buy Jack Daniel's whiskey. I never had a bad drink from a Jack Daniel's bottle. Sure, it'll probably deteriorate your liver like Mickey Mantle and probably kill you at an early age. But you'll enjoy it. It's a lot of fun. Or go out and buy an airplane and burn up the money in airplane gas. It'll be a blast. You'll love it. It'll really titillate your senses. And you'll have a good time. And sure, the family that flies together dies together. But hell, you got to die sometime, don't you? Now, that's what I call living it up, burning the candle on both ends, and having a good time while you're doing it. I can't see any point in investing the money with Bill Gates when he doesn't pay me any dividends. I can't understand why I should give Bill Gates $10,000 of my money so that he can hold it for the next 5 or 10 years, pay me no dividends, and then give me back my $10,000, which then, like as not, I'll have to pay some capital gain tax on, and then, like as not, when it's all said and done, I lose purchasing power. And so then I can go out in the marketplace and spend, you know, say, $7,500 or $8,000 of it and get what I could have bought, you know, for $10,000 and would have had $2,000 more goods, and I spent the money early on. So the way I got it figured, stocks and bonds are a surefire loser, and there's no point in buying them. That's the ugly truth in investing in stocks and bonds. That's where reality is located. Now, that's what recession is all about. Recession is a loss of purchasing power and a degeneration in your standard of living. Now, we've been in recession for 18 months, and buying stocks and bonds exacerbates the inflation. It exacerbates the recession, and it doesn't do anything for you in the process. Now, let's hear it for the Dow Jones Industrial Average. And while you're hip-hipping and hooraying there for the Dow Jones, let me remind you that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard worldwide over the Internet. If you'd like more information about the law school and The Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, and agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective, and business law. I wanted to emphasize that for you, business law. We can count here. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information, please go to the homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated every week. It has our radio log schedule and archives, and that can be accessed through the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest, and The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. And we do it 7 days a week. Now, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the law school at 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. And I should remind you that the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. And the Law Hour and editorial review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. And we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that those authors or publications that we endorse or recommend are necessarily going to reciprocate. And that's because most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour are hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and editorial review. Now, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of our advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this network or of this local radio station. Now, if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, then go to our website, georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about the R word, recession. Now, I mentioned to you that we're in recession, have been for 18 months, and that's because when a recession occurs, the gross domestic product ceases to grow at a rate of 2% per annum or more. And so our government says, okay, that's recession. Well, now we've been in this growth pattern of less than 2% over the past 18 months. The truth of the matter is it's been worse than that for a longer period. Let me describe it for you. Let's suppose for the sake of our discussion that you and I are in the widget business and we produce widgets and we sell them for a dollar a piece. And we produce 100 widgets and we sell the 100 widgets, and that's our economic base. And so we want to measure our economic base and ask ourselves, well, is our business growing or is our business staying the same or is our business declining? And so we measure the widgets that we made and sold last year, and we made 100 widgets, we sold 100 widgets, and therefore our economic base is 100. So we take a look at this year's sales and we say, wow, this year we're selling widgets at the rate of 2% more than we sold last year. And if this continues on for the rest of the year, we're going to sell 102 widgets. We're going to have a 2% growth rate. Now, we could go back over the last 10 years and we could say, well, what's our growth rate been over the last 10 years? Well, if in, let's say, the year 1997, we sold 100 widgets, and in 1998, we sold 102 widgets, and then in 1999, we sold 104 widgets, and then, you know, time goes on and we keep selling more widgets, we can progress and we can calculate the rate of growth. Now, let's suppose that we were producing 100 widgets back in 1997, and we produced 100 widgets in 1998, but we raised the price on our widgets by 2%. Our bottom line would show that we had a growth rate of 2% because we had 2% more revenue. But the truth of the matter is we didn't produce any more widgets than we did in 1997. We produced the same 100 widgets for the year. Our actual growth rate measured in widgets is exactly the same. It's static, but we made 2% more money. So that's what we call nominal growth, but it's not real growth. Now, we Americans have been experiencing nominal growth for many, many years. We got off on this nominal growth thing back in 1933 with Franklin D. Roosevelt when we started this program of inflation. So a little inflation makes people feel real good. It's kind of like drinking whiskey at a party, you know. When you walk in, you know, you're looking around and saying, well, gee, I don't know anybody here, and I'm not having any fun. So you go over and you have a whiskey sour, and, you know, pretty soon you start feeling like, well, gee, maybe there is somebody here. I know there's old Bob over there. You go over and talk to old Bob with your second whiskey sour, and after you get through talking with Bob over here, now you start to feel, hey, I know that guy over there, too. And pretty soon, you know, you're having a good time. And by the time you got six or eight of these in you, why now you're the life of the party, and things are really going great. That's part of the good news, bad news thing. You know, now the party's going on. Everybody's having a good time. Now, tomorrow, there's going to be reality check. We're going to have a hangover tomorrow if we drink too much here today. And this is what happens when you create too much money. You start having a hangover. This hangover is called a recession. It's the boom and bust cycle. Now, I think boom times are wonderful. God, I love boom times and I love parties. I love drinking and smoking and chasing wild women. But, you know, there's a price you got to pay. I showed you that last week. We were talking about health last week. And I said, you know, they're just all these good things out here to eat, you know, like Oreo cookies. And the ultimate end of that, though, is cancer. And if you eat too many Oreo cookies, you know, you can get away with eating one once in a while. You can get away with smoking a Roy Tan, drinking a whiskey sour. But, you know, if you get off drinking too much, smoking too much, chasing too many wild women, all of a sudden, there's reality comes back on you. And that's what we're talking about here with recession. You know, we figured that a little bit of inflation was good, so a whole lot of inflation must be real, real good. Now, we used to inflate the economy by about 1%, you know. And they'd go out here and they'd produce 100 widgets, and then they'd actually charge a little bit more for them, you know, print a little extra money, put it out in circulation, made everybody feel a little bit euphoric, you know, kind of like that first and second drink. Okay, well then, as time progresses along, though, and as you keep doing this, you get to a point in time where you have to continually take more in order to get the same effect. And we notice that with heroin. You know, this heroin, it's great stuff. Everybody loves it. Never talked to anybody that was on heroin, didn't like it. That old Dr. Sansoni, one time I was in the hospital, and he came in, he gave me a shot of morphine. He said, "You're going to like this." Boy, he was right about that. Boy, I really like that morphine. Then he gave me a little sobering up. He said, "Now, you don't want to take any more of this morphine than you need to in order to control the pain, because if you do, you'll become addicted to it. And when you become addicted to it, we call it heroin on the street. We call it morphine here in the hospital." That sobered me up right quick. And I said, "Oh, no, that doesn't sound very good." He said, "Yeah, it's real hard to get off of it. It's real expensive out on the street. It's just kind of moderately expensive here in the hospital, but it's real expensive out on the street. And once you get hooked on it, you can't get off of it." So I said, "Well, I think I better avoid that heroin stuff." So I didn't take very much of that. But they tell us, though, that when you get hooked on this heroin, so you got to have more and more of it to get the same effect. I had an old business associate one time, old Darwin. He's a Canadian, big Canadian. And he used to drink a little bit. And we'd go out and drink. And Darwin could drink 18 highballs in the course of the evening. I know somebody got to write me a letter and say, "Well, now you're a liar. You know, nobody can drink 18 highballs." Oh, yeah, you can. Darwin could. Now, normal people can't drink 18, and I suspect that you're kind of normal, but old Darwin, you know, he'd been drinking for a lot of years. And so for Darwin, you know, you could ride with old Darwin in his car with 18 highballs in him, and he'd do a better job than I'd do with four or five. And in fact, I've often said I'd rather ride with old Darwin drunk than I would with most people sober. He's a pretty good driver, too. My old daddy was like that. I don't know if my old daddy ever drove drunk, but I don't ever remember him driving sober, so I assume he was always drunk. He was always drinking, but I don't think he was drunk driving, you know. But my old daddy used to drink and drive. People want to know how come he was drinking and driving. Well, because after you drink for a while, you're in no condition to walk, so you have to drive. That's the way we used to see it in the old days. Well, anyway, this thing of money works the same way. To get the same effect in the economy, you have to produce more money. And right now, the government is printing 10% more money every year. Now, here's what the bottom line to that is. If you print 10% more money and your economy is growing 2% a year, you're in a recession at 8 percentage points per year. Can you do the arithmetic on that, children? You take 10% more money. We're going to raise our prices 10%, and our business is growing. We're selling two more widgets, but we're charging 10% more money. And what that really goes to show us over here is that we're really not producing 10% more real growth in widgets. We're producing 10% more nominal growth in price increase. And you know that price increase comes back and bites you in the butt over time, and that's what's happening to us, and that's why you're losing all these jobs to the Chinese. Because see, the Chinese over here, they're not denominating their money in dollars. They're denominating their money in yuan. And they got those people working over there for yuan. See, and they're not paying them as much as they pay us over here. And so now we've got this outsourcing of jobs. You know, the jobs, you know, they're dismantling everything and sending it overseas. And, you know, it makes all the economic sense in the world. You know, if you're paying some steel worker in this country $15 or $20 an hour, and you can build a steel mill over in Bangladesh, and you can get an Indian to go do the same work over there for $3 a day, and then import that steel into the United States and not have to pay any tariffs on it, well, you know, that's the way to add and subtract. That's why these young fellas, they go to Harvard Business School and they get their MBAs, you know, and then they say, "Well, we know how to make money. We'll just ship this job over to India." Now, I don't see where that does Joe Sixpack working in the steel mill any good, but Joe Sixpack is convinced that outsourcing of jobs and a world trade and global economy makes all the sense in the world. Our founding fathers at the Constitutional Convention, they didn't see it that way. They put on tariffs, and they ran the government by financing it through these import-export tariffs. But, you know, today we want to take all these tariffs off. I noticed that the Japanese don't do that. They make us pay through the nose when we want to import stuff into their country and sell it, but they want to be able to sell their Toyotas over here without paying any import tax on it. I say that's real good for the Japanese, but I don't see how that has any advantage for Joe Sixpack working in Poughkeepsie, New York. Do you? Well, anyway, that's what economy is all about. Now, we get our reports from Katie Couric and Brian Williams and Charlie Gibson, and they tell us that the economy is strong and vibrant. Well, where did they get those words, strong and vibrant? Did they get that from George Bush? Or where'd George Bush get strong and vibrant? Because our economy over the last 18 months has been contracting at about 8 percentage points a month. Excuse me, 8 percentage points a year. Not per month, though. 8 points a year. Now, the government lies to us a lot. They have what they call the Consumer Price Index. And if you look at the Consumer Price Index, today. They have what they call this hedonic adjustments. For instance, they don't count food and fuel and gasoline, or they leave certain things out and they put other things in, or they come up with novel new ideas. Like if you bought a computer in 2000 for $1,000 and you bought a computer that does more than the computer did in 2000 for $800, they price that into the consumer price index and they tell you, well, see, it costs less to live in America today. Well, let me tell you, children, you know, I'm an old man. I ain't never bought a computer, and if I live to be 110, I can't imagine buying one. I'm pushing 70 and never bought a new car in my life, and if I live to be 110, I don't expect to buy a new one for the rest of my life. So go ahead and plug that into the consumer price index and see what that shows you. All right. Now, the reason I bring this to your attention is because I don't think that we're getting the correct numbers out of the Department of Labor. I think they're lying a lot. And the reason I say they're lying and not mistaken is because I think that they changed this under the Clinton administration to use what we call these hedonic adjustments. So that as inflation is running more than 4%, they don't have to report that as running 4%. They report it as running 1.4%. Now, you and I both know that if inflation is 1.4%, we're not at all concerned about that. If it was running 4%, we might raise an eyebrow. But if inflation was running 8 or 10%. Now, inflation is running at 11.9% last time I saw the international forecast, 11.9. See, there's other people that keep track of prices, and they do it a little differently than the Department of Labor, and they say, well, you know, take a look at gasoline that's going up in price. Did you notice that? For the election, George Bush and company engineered the price, and it went down to below $2. Now it's up to $2.45 here at my local station, and I saw some numbers the other day that were kind of frightening. It's over $3 out in California, $3 a gallon. Now, I don't know if $3 a gallon is too much. I'm just a reporter. I'm just here to tell you that the price of gasoline is going up, but they don't count that. See, the price of food is going up. Now, we've got some grain shortfalls. For instance, did you know that the Chinese are harvesting less wheat this year than they did last year? And the Australians, they're harvesting less wheat this year than last year. And understand that the Americans are doing the same. And so now there's still some wheat stocks. I'm not trying to panic you now into going out here and buying some wheat thins, but I wanted to point out to you that when grain production goes down, prices go up. Now, the prices on foods over the last year have gone up 18%. Did you know that? See, maybe you're not keeping track of the price of wheat thins in the grocery store because you buy a lot of Coca-Cola and the price of Coke maybe went down a dime, but I just wanted to point out to you that the general price increase in food over the past 12 months is 18%, up 18%. They don't report that in the Department of Labor. They take certain products and they weigh them against other products that go down. They don't give you the straight skinny. Here's an example of it. Let's suppose that you were eating Kansas City strip steak last year, and then the prices go up 18% this year. Now, that doesn't turn you into a vegetarian, but it means that you're going to be eating less Kansas City strip steak and probably more stew meat and more hamburger than you are steak. Not that you won't have a steak every once in a while, but you're going to have less of them, and that's because prices have gone up 18%. And then as prices go up another 5 or 10 or 15%, you know, the next year it's less and less and less. Over time, this erodes your standard of living. And that's where we've been since 1973. We are suffering through an erosion of our standard of living. Now, you know, you got your wife out working, and so you've maintained your 1973 standard of living, but you had to produce twice as much labor to do it. So you're working twice as hard to live just as well as you did in 1973. I don't call that progress. And so I thought I would report that to you, give you an update, and tell you where you are and where you're going, because the president and the Department of Labor have been lying to us. And in my case, I don't really care all that much one way or the other, because I haven't taken a cut in my standard of living. And I'm doing just fine, thank you. And my wife isn't out working, you know, at some, you know, at Walmart, you know, and as a checker or a cashier or something. Not that I'm opposed to labor. I'm just telling you that I didn't need my wife out there working to support me. And we used to think that was kind of poor when you had to have your wife out working. When I was a kid, if a woman was out working, it meant that the husband couldn't support his family. And that was a shame. And if you were on welfare or food stamps, they used to call that the dole. If you were on the dole, that was a shame. Now, today, people look at you like, you know, if you're not on the dole, there's something wrong with you. Now, I'll give you an illustration. See, I'm pushing 70 now, and I'm old enough to be drawing Social Security, but I don't draw Social Security, and I'm still out here working. I'm still out here working. I'm not drawing Social Security, and I hope to live to be 110 years old and never draw one Social Security check. I hope I can live to be 110. How many payments would that be? I could have retired at 62, 72, 82, 92, 102, be 40 years. I hope to live 38 years times 12. And miss 456 Social Security payments. I mention that to people, and they say, you've got to be suffering from the terminal stupids to pass up your Social Security check. Why, you've got to be mentally retarded or something, maybe even brain dead. No, sir, Bob, I don't want the dole. And then I want to work every day, and I want to get paid, and I want to get paid in gold. I want to make some real increase. But I don't want to make it off of you or somebody else. I want to make it myself. I want to go out and use my own labor, and I want to produce 110 widgets. I want a 10% growth, real growth. I want to produce more schools this year than I did last year. I want to actually produce the real thing. I want to produce more milk this year than I produced last year. And I don't want to charge more money for it. I just want to produce more of it at the same price to give you consumers real value. Real value. I know it's a wild new concept. Most people don't want to do that. They want to charge more and produce less. Workmen are like that. Labor's like that. They want to get more money for less work. They don't want to work 40 hours a week. They want to work 35 hours a week and get paid as if they were working 45 hours a week. Unfortunately, boys and girls, that isn't possible. Well, not out here in the real world. Now, there's an artificial world out there that I'm describing to you that's been going on here for about 75 years. It started with the Roosevelt people back in 1933. It was inflating the economy. A little bit of inflation is good. Today, we're up to 10.9%. That's 11% in real terms. That 11% inflation is going to go up to 20% inflation here pretty shortly. 20% inflation. We're headed for hyperinflation. And down in Brazil, when they tried it down there one time, they went up to 5,000% inflation in 3 days. 5,000% in 3 days. Well, boys and girls, it's coming to a city near you very shortly. Well, I'm about out of time, so I'm going to have to give you a friendly reminder here that you've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide, over the Internet. If you'd like more information about the law school, The Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals by prearrangement. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information, then please go to our homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. And the Law Hour is an educational service brought to your public interest. Air time's up. I've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God bless. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody. And a good night, friends.